You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of our best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So over the weekend, a good friend of mine stayed over and we ended up getting onto the topic of euthanasia and assisted suicide. Their position was basically that it is moral and in specific circumstances, not giving people the option to end their lives like in a way that is peaceful and doesn't cause pain and in a controlled environment is unethical. And my position pretty much was that I just think that even if it can be administered in an ethical way, most of the time the circumstances around the commercialization of assisted dying and euthanasia makes it more likely than not that it will be executed in a way that is unethical. So that's the subject matter of today's episode. I want to talk about the ethics and the morals of assisted dying and euthanasia. In case you haven't, you know, looked at the official definition, it's defined as, for euthanasia, it's defined as the act of deliberately ending a person's life to relieve suffering. And then assisted suicide is helping somebody in the act of ending their lives. Sometimes it comes under different terms as well. So sometimes instead of assisted dying, it's assisted suicide. Sometimes it's physician-assisted suicide. But pretty much for euthanasia, it's the same term. Now, firstly, before I go into the morals and the ethics and what I think at this age, at this time in my life, just the legality of it specifically, I wanted to see like how many countries around the world, you know, have either decriminalized or explicitly legalized euthanasia or assisted suicide or assisted dying. And honestly, it's not that many. So in the UK, it's still illegal for both euthanasia and assisted dying. In Europe, only 9 countries have laws that permit it. When I looked at Africa, it's not legal in any single country. In Latin America, the numbers were a little bit higher. So out of all of Latin America, 3 countries allow it or permit it. So that's Colombia, that's Cuba, and that's Ecuador. And then also when I looked at Asia, there was nowhere in which it was legal or like decriminalized. The exception actually is Japan, where they don't criminalize it and they allow certain forms of like passive assisted dying by physicians. So if the physician like stopped providing care that preserves life, it's basically helping the person along because you're no longer intervening in preserving their lives. So that's not criminalized, but all other like explicit acts of helping people end their lives are illegal. In other places in the Americas, specifically North America, it is legal in Canada, but in the US, it's only legal in certain states. I think it's about 10 of them. Now, I thought it would be fair if I presented like the 5 strongest arguments that people who are in favor of legislation changing in favor of assisted dying and euthanasia. I thought it would be fair if I presented like their best case arguments, and then I would give my opinions after that. And there are a number of things like when you read literature around it or just like articles around it that comes up over and over again. One of them is around the fact that it's already happening. So if you look at the proportion of people who commit suicide, 7% of those deaths in the UK, for example, comprise of people who aren't suicidal in the traditional sense, where like they can't cope with the lives that they're leading for whatever reason, and so feel like their only way out is to end their lives. It's the 7% they're referring to are people who would otherwise wish to live, but because of the medical condition that they have that is, you know, causing them like physical suffering or other forms of psychological suffering, they choose to end their lives. So in the UK, that's the figure for the UK. It's about 77% of all suicides are down to people who would have otherwise gone for assisted suicide or euthanasia if it was legal in the UK. And, you know, putting that number into context, that's roughly about 650 people every year. And given that the population of the UK is 68 million as of like 2023 or 2024, those 650 people represent like, not like exactly, because I just calculated it, represent not 9%. So it's a very, very small percentage of people. But what proponents speak about in regards to this point, it's not just that there are people doing it already. It's that because there aren't any legal forms of ending your lives, people essentially resort to like really unsafe methods of inflicting death upon themselves. And so the idea is that if there was a place where they could go, where there were medical practitioners, where they could be comfortable, then they wouldn't have to resort to ways of ending their lives that honestly can be very brutal and very violent and can basically be a very distressing way for them to go, and also a very distressing way for their family members to find them. And with this point, like, I totally agree. Of course, in like a medicalized environment, all those horrible things would go away. The second thing that proponents of assisted dying and euthanasia speak about is that people who are already suffering from debilitating illnesses that are often terminal, that often have been accompanied with just like extreme physical suffering, and also just like come with seeing themselves, like seeing who they were in their former lives when they were well, essentially like become increasingly further away. So they lose their sense of identity, they lose their sense of belonging, they lose their sense of like who they are, because they can no longer, for example, go to work or like do the leisurely activities they used to engage in. Like, let's say somebody used to play sports, they can't do that anymore. Their social lives are going to be impacted. The way in which other people relate to them is going to change, because now they're like a sick person, a chronically sick person, and the things that they talk about and the way that people see them changes. And so basically all those factors contribute to people inherently feeling out of control because they're losing their identity and because their lives are changing in like these like extreme ways. And so what proponents say is that at the very least with assisted dying, they can assert some level of control over their lives again, because instead of sort of having to guess when death will come or having to guess how much more their bodies are going to be broken down by their illnesses or conditions, they can basically say that if they get to a certain point where their quality of life is at a specified level, they can exercise agency and choice and control and choose to end their lives in a way that essentially like preserves their dignity, that preserves some level of their self-identity, and also means that they don't have to fear like more unknowns and more suffering down the line. Now, what I would say, or my initial feelings towards this point, is I would say like that the fear of the unknown, or the fear of dying, or the fear of not knowing how or when you will die, is not a unique experience to the terminally ill or to the chronically ill. All of us, most of us, will never know when we're going to die or how we're going to die. And that naturally, of course, is going to come with some level of fear. And so if we could choose when we are going to die, I think maybe a lot of us, even outside like this conversation of assisted dying, maybe we might make the choice to do so because it gives you an opportunity to tie up loose ends. It gives you an opportunity to say goodbye to loved ones, or to say things that you wanted to say but didn't have the courage, or you felt like it wasn't the right time because you don't have time left and you know you don't have time left. You might have conversations that you otherwise wouldn't have. So it's not a unique component, like the idea of not knowing when or not knowing how or wishing to have control over the timing of your death. That's not unique to people with, you know, terminal diseases or chronic pain. It's just part of the human experience. Another thing is that often the conversation around assisted dying in the things that I've read, like they use the term imminent death. So they are trying to focus on the group that is terminally ill or has some debilitating condition, and basically their death is soon to come. So they might only have 6 months to live, they might only have like 3 months to live. So because their deaths are already so imminent, they say, why not allow them to have some semblance of control over how and when they go? Because then they can preserve, one, some level of dignity, second, they can also avoid some unnecessary like physical suffering that comes with their condition. What I will say about this is, like, most people who die in like hospital or hospice or palliative care facilities, like, often don't actually experience violent like or like horrific deaths. Like, most of the time, because they're in a medicalized environment already anyway, like part of the doctor or physician's duty is to make them as comfortable as possible. And so they're going to be on medication that removes most of that suffering, if not all. And then secondly, most people who die in hospitals or in those types of environments tend to go into a coma and basically don't feel anything at all, like physically, because they're in a coma, and they tend to slip away. So the number of people who, like, it's a horrific, like, violent, aggressive death when they have a terminal illness, like that's a very, very small percentage of people. And because they're experiencing that level of suffering, it kind of implies that they're not getting the healthcare that they should receive. Because as I said, like most people in hospitals who are being treated in a palliative way, so not being treated with the assumption that they're ever going to get better, again, they have a lot of like pain easing medication. The second last reason I'll talk about that proponents of assisted dying euthanasia speak about is the idea that it's easier, that it's an easier way of going for the person's loved ones. So if you're somebody who has like a parent or a grandparent or like a partner or an uncle or an auntie who suffers from a debilitating condition that it's terminal, where basically they're suffering, it's easier for them because sometimes, and this is not, you know, probably not talked about a lot, but sometimes like their loved ones kind of want them to go because they want their suffering to end. And so they're kind of secretly like wishing for them to go quicker so that the suffering ends for them. And so the idea with assisted dying is that it basically fulfills that wish. It's like the person is suffering, they're in immense pain, their death is imminent anyhow. And instead of sort of having a drawn out sort of painful death, they can basically die in a peaceful way surrounded by the people that they love. Because a lot of people opt to die in a facility where their family members can visit, or sometimes even are able to do it at home if it's like medications they have gotten from a physician. And they say this is particularly the case if the alternative is that the person or the people, if they don't have access to assisted dying or euthanasia by like an official provider, that they're going to try and end their lives themselves. Like proponents say that that's a worst case scenario because not only are they ending their lives in ways that are probably like very distressing, as I mentioned earlier, that causes probably a lot of damage that didn't need to be caused. It also has an impact in the family members that find them. And so finding a person that you love, seeing what they did to themselves and ending their lives and being left with that image as like the final memory of them is very painful and traumatic for the people concerned. And so obviously euthanasia and assisted dying would forego that, because instead of people resorting to other ways of ending their own lives, they could be surrounded by family members and people they love in their own homes in comfortable environments. And so in terms of how the family or the loved ones cope after the fact, it's clearly like a less traumatic experience. Now, I largely agree, especially if the alternative is that people are going to end their lives in ways that are very like traumatic. And I'm sure you can imagine some of the ways that might be. I definitely, that's true. But I also think that, again, it's not black and white, because it depends on who is witnessing the death. Like if you're a young person and let's say like a family member, like a close family member, like a parent has opted to commit suicide through the assistance of a physician or another like provider of that service. And in order for you to be supportive and to be there for them, they're probably going to want you to be in the room, even though you might secretly prefer not to be there in the final moments where that happens. Like, I still think that that's a psychologically damaging experience to go through. Of course, it's less traumatic than finding a loved one in potentially a very distressing position. But I still don't think that it's like roses in comparison. I still think like there's other things that come with that. You're still left with the memory of the moment between life and death. You're still left with the memory of like a syringe being injected into their arms and still witness their last gasp, or still like remember the sounds that they made as they're dying. It's not as though like these medications necessarily always guarantee like a quiet, calm death. Like sometimes like it can be louder than you expect. Sometimes the person can respond to the medication in a way that you didn't expect. Or in like one of the cases that I read, like horrors of horrors, you can think that the person is dead, but actually like they're not. So one case I read was a man was like given this medication and the family was around him. They thought that he was dead, only to come to find out like 65 hours later, he awoke, like still alive, groggy and like worse for wear, but still alive. And obviously, again, that's a very traumatic experience. And actually, he died like a month later. So I agree, it is probably a less traumatic way if the alternative is that the person takes their lives in a damaging or distressing way. But I also don't think that it's fair to say that it's not traumatizing. It has its own way of being traumatic, and potentially maybe it's like a little bit less, like marginally less traumatic. But still, either way, the trauma is going to be there because it inherently involves watching the person you love like die before your eyes. And then the final sort of major argument that comes up in favor of assisted dying and euthanasia is just an appeal to reducing the suffering of the terminally ill. And obviously there's conditions in which like the medication is going to do its work, like the medication to reduce their pain is going to do its work. But there are also like other conditions where there's limitations to how much discomfort the pain relieving medication can alleviate. And so the argument essentially goes like, if you have like something like throat cancer where you can't swallow and you can't eat and you have to be fed through a tube, or you have things like motor neuron disease where your mind is completely alive and active and can feel everything, can process everything, but you're essentially like a prisoner in your body, and that your body is like breaking down and you can't do anything for yourself, and it also comes with like extreme pain that medication can't always alleviate, then they basically say like giving people the option to escape this torture is an act of kindness, and that given that their lifespan is probably going to be shortened anyway, then it's an act of kindness to reduce the amount of suffering that they experience whilst they are like still living. And I 100% agree with that. It is like in principle and in theory, it is an act of kindness to be able to reduce people suffering in all circumstances, especially when there's no prospects for them to get better. However, even with these arguments, and like I said earlier, like many of them I agree with, some of them I agree with, or components of them I agree with, I'm still against assisted dying fundamentally. Because, and by the way, I don't mean like a partner, like people have been helping their loved ones die since time began. So I'm not talking specifically about like intimate relationships where you help a loved one, like, you know, expedite their deaths. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about specifically about physicians or doctors or institutions doing that for you, or being the people or organizations that administer that service, quote unquote. Now, one of the fundamental reasons why I think it is very unlikely that assisted dying, like physician-assisted dying or physician-assisted suicides or euthanasia, are going to be practiced in an ethical way is because we live in the world that we live in now, and that world is a capitalist world in which the economy and the idea of trade and the idea of money is essentially at the heart of everything we do, and it takes precedence over basically like human life in a very basic way. And what I mean by that is you can tell that money or capital is more important than people, like in many ways around us. So for example, like human beings who need money to do everything from like get food, to have shelter, to buy clothes, to buy healthcare. They need money for all these things, but yet in like many countries, like we don't pay them a living wage. We don't pay them a salary that allows them to live, like a salary that allows them to have money to do all the things that a human being needs to do in order to thrive and do well and just like lead like a happy, normal life. This money-centered world also like takes millions of people and sticks them in prisons so that corporations can use them as like free slave labor sources, essentially. And without like money, like because money is at the root of everything that we do, like people who don't have money are literally left to die. Like they will have treatable illnesses, but because they don't have money to treat those illnesses will develop into something increasingly more serious, the point where that initially simple, treatable condition now becomes a life-threatening illness because they don't have the money to deal with it. So literally people die because they don't have the money to get like the healthcare that they need. And if we lived in a world where human beings and human well-being was at the center of everything that we did as opposed to money, that could never run, that could never happen. Another example that tells you that like our capitalist world doesn't care about human life is that even in our in the things that we consume, like on a daily basis, there is so much corporate neglect that is allowed that we allow these corporations or our governments allow these corporations to like put chemicals in our cooking utensils that hurt us or harm our health or even in certain like circumstances kill us. Or in the production of our food, they use so many pesticides that end up leaching into the flesh of the food. And instead of just like killing the pesticides, like the pests, so like the bugs on the vegetables and fruits that they're trying to kill, it also ends up like hurting us as well, like causing us illnesses because we're not supposed to be injecting all those like industrial level like chemicals and pesticides. Like many times the government is aware that this is taking place. So because again, these corporations are making money for the economy and for the country, they're essentially allowed to kill off human beings in various ways because they're making the country money, or they're making the state money, or they're paying the state taxes. That's another example of the fundamental like disregard for human life. And actually in the topic of like production of food and food in general, we also have a situation where there's actual food warfare, where like agricultural corporations literally manufacture our food so that it doesn't produce seeds because they don't want us to be able to grow our own vegetables. And so you have the situation where people are living in food deserts. They can't even go to the store and like buy like, let's say, peppers and tomatoes and things that have with seeds and go and plant them in their back garden and grow food for themselves and their families. Like they can't even find a way of being able to produce their own foods because these corporations are allowed to act in like fundamentally like human hating ways or life hating ways. And then finally on the subject of like just the sheer disregard for human life, like people, particularly like poor people, are sent to fight in pointless wars like the war in Vietnam or the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan. And usually they send young people, usually they send poor people, usually they send like a disproportionate number of people of color to these wars. And whilst they're losing their lives in like these faraway places, like the children of people like Bush or Obama or Tony Blair or like Dick Cheney or Trump, like their children, because they're children who are wealthy and can do well under capitalism, like they're allowed to stay home safely. Now that's like at a base level for like most people. That's the world in which we live in. When you are an old person or an older person, or God forbid, like you become like sick or disabled, or in other ways cease to essentially be like an economic producer. So you stop earning money, you stop being productive, you essentially in this world stop being useful. You stop being considered as like a valuable member of society, and people and the infrastructure and the like political system like starts to treat you in all kinds of little and big ways in a way that implies that you are superfluous or you are surplus to requirement or you are like essentially like a waste material. Now like that sounds harsh, but that's how they treat older people, and that's how they treat like sick people who can't work. And you can hear some of this language in like even when like politicians are running for office. I noticed this most recently in the UK, where we have like we've recently had an election like a year or so ago, and Labour came in and they hadn't been in office for like 15, 16, 17 years. And Labour is supposed to be like the left leaning like political party. They're supposed to be the party that cares about like Palestine and the environment, and they're supposed to be for like public like services. They're supposed to be for like provisions for the most vulnerable amongst us. And the thing about this specific administration is that it's like the most like right wing, like most conservative labor government we've ever seen. So it's basically like there's been no change in the way people, like vulnerable people, the masses, poor people are living under this administration, because they're literally the exact same as the conservatives. And so what I noticed in the language that they use in like their pamphlets, in their speeches, is they keep talking about how they want to make life better for working people. And initially I didn't think much of it. Like, working people, it's a relatively innocuous term. I was like, okay, yeah, they just mean people. They just have chosen to use the term working people. But then later on, they passed or suggested passing legislation that dramatically reduces the social provisions that disabled people receive and long-term ill people receive. And so that cast that term in a more sinister term, because what they're saying is they're trying to make life better for working people. And so the other people who aren't working people, i.e. pensioners, i.e. the sick, the long-term sick, the disabled, the people who for whatever physical and psychological reason are not able to participate as economic agents, they're not trying to make a country that is for them. They're not trying to pass policies that are going to benefit them. They're specifically saying our policies are for working people. And so again, like going back to what I said earlier about the fundamental like disregard for human life, it's already bad as at a base level under capitalism, but it's significantly worse for people who are sick or who have terminal illnesses or who are disabled or for whatever reason are unable to work because of like healthcare needs. And doubly worse if they have all of that and they're like older people. Now, why all of that is relevant in this discussion is that because we're socialized and we live in a system where our lives aren't valued, so like I said, the corporations are allowed to kill us in all these different ways and the government never intervenes, or people who can't produce for the economy are disregarded or abandoned or treated just terribly because they aren't economic agents. It manifests in all these other like related ways. So an example of that is like many times when you live, especially in the West, like people have to work all the time. They have to work until like their 70 or late 60s or early 70s now in some places. And they work like 35 hours a week, 40 hours a week for higher paying jobs. They tend to work like even more hours, or sometimes for very low paying jobs where they have to supplement their work with like second or third or fourth jobs. Then they also work like extremely long hours. And so that means that when it comes to like the care of our elders, the care of like elderly people, we don't have the time and we often don't have the means. And so families, when they're facing like healthcare bills that's associated with like older people, they are already under extreme financial duress, especially in the context of like countries like the United States. As I said in previous episodes, like the National Health Service in the UK is pretty good. And so luckily, like that direct financial stress is less, but in countries where they don't have like healthcare, it means that on top of living in a world where human life is degraded in all kinds of ways and older and sicker people are considered like waste materials or like burdens or financial or economic burdens, families themselves are under extreme financial duress and strain because literally every component of their lives is commodified. Like everything, they've got to pay for everything. Their food, their shelter, their transport, their childcare, their medicine, their leisure, their education, even in some circumstances, their safety. And so when they're living these kinds of lives and living in this kind of context, when they are faced with like the care and specifically the associated health bills of older people or people who might not even be older but just become sick, there is like literally no way that they are not going to consider what is the cheaper option. They're going to look at, and by the way, this can be super expensive, like putting somebody in a residential care place or a like medicalized environment that is in a hospital. It can be thousands of dollars or thousands of pounds or thousands of euros a month. And so comparing that cost with a one-off cost of assisted dying or euthanasia, that is always going to be the cheaper option. I read one particular case where a woman was like extremely sick. It wasn't terminal, but she had cancer that had been in remission but came back. And her insurance did cover her medication initially, but that was at a cost of $4,000 a year. And for some reason, like something changed and the health insurance firm like didn't want to pay for the treatment any longer. And so obviously the woman, she didn't have $4,000 to suddenly like start paying, neither did her family. However, the cost of assisted dying treatment, quote unquote, or assisted dying pills in this case, they were $50. A one-off $50 bill versus a $4,000 monthly reoccurring fee. And so what happens when this option is introduced? So the option of a 50-pound alternative to the $4,000, it affects every person concerned. For the family members who are responsible for the care of the person who's older or sick, that's going to factor into their calculus when they're considering what is best for the family and best for the person, or best for like all the parties involved. That's going to be a kernel of thought in their minds, whether they wanted to or not. Because again, like even if morally they're opposed, practically speaking, we live in a world that like is money's at the center of things. Like they can't get this healthcare for free. They have to come up with the money somehow. And so of course, when they don't have the money, when they're already under financial duress from all the other financial obligations that they have, it's going to taint their lens or taint their perspective. Also from the perspective of the person who is ill, they also know that that's the choice that their family is facing. Even if the family like is nothing but kind, nothing but sweet, nothing but supportive, nothing but like, we are going to pay for you until as long as you need. Even if that's the kind of language that they use, the family member who is unwell or older or unwell and older is going to feel like there's a level of like guilt that comes from making your family, quote unquote, spend like $4,000 a month that they already don't have, especially when it's like poor or middle income people. That's a significant amount of money. And so introducing this assisted dying or this euthanasia corrupts every person involved, or every party involved. It corrupts their incentive. For the family member's perspective, it affects how they like analyze the situation, but also for the person who is like the subject of the matter or the subject of the discussion, they also are going to feel pressured. Even if it isn't from the family saying anything, they're going to feel like a burden. They're going to feel like maybe it will be cheaper for me to not be here. And by the way, like people making choices for themselves that aren't necessarily good, but doing it for the benefit of their family is like a common thing. Like kids, for example, who know that their family members can't afford things, like their parents or guardians can't afford things, sometimes don't ask for the things that they need. It could even be things like school books or going on school trips that might enrich their school experience. They might not ask for those things because they don't want to be a financial burden on their family members. Or for example, parents who aren't sick, but they're under financial duress, sometimes they might be behind on a mortgage payment or behind on treatment or behind on some other expense. And because they don't want to put like pressure on their children, because they don't want to be a burden to their children, they just won't say anything. So there's no way, when the cost is even higher, when the bills are even higher, that like loved ones aren't going to feel like it's better for them not to be a burden. And unfortunately, if the option is on the table that they can choose like a $50 solution versus like a $50 one-off solution versus the $4,000 or more in some circumstances recurring payment, that is going to enter their mind. And even if they don't do anything about it, it's still going to be something that like is on their mind, that they think about. It's going to taint their interactions with their family members. It's going to make themselves smaller or more invisible, or like find in other ways to make themselves either useful or make themselves like less of a burden to like family members. And that's like the best case scenario, assuming the person has a kind, loving, like sweet, like moral family. Like not everybody has that. Not everybody has like family members who like aren't vultures. Some people will come from backgrounds and from families where that pressure we put on them in all kinds of subtle and like explicit ways. Outside like the impact that having that option or choice has on family members and like loved ones and the person who's sick, it also factors into the calculus of how insurance firms like operate and the choices that they make. As in the case that I just gave, where the insurance firm like denied the woman the healthcare she had been receiving because they passed legislation. I think this was in Oregon, where they passed this legislation that basically legalized assisted dying. They changed, they made the choice to not offer her the $4,000 a month in healthcare insurance after the bill had passed. And so insurance firms in general, we already know how they operate. They're going to go with a cheaper option. They fundamentally do not care if they like expedite your death or cause you to die because you can't receive the healthcare that you need from them because they won't cover it. And so what happens and what has happened is that given the option between paying for expensive healthcare bills versus paying for the one-off like $50 payment to end somebody's life, well, guess what option they've chosen? Guess what options they go for? That calculus now becomes like a standing base level choice that's available to insurance firms. And I'm sure in more cases than not, they're going to go, unless like the legislation around it changes and makes it more like stringent in the things that these firms can and can't do, unless that changes, they're always literally going to funnel people into making the choice to end their lives because it's more profitable for them to do so. And by the way, like sometimes we think that wealthy people are like protected from some of this. The case for the Luigi Mangione case, where like the guy who suffered from chronic back pain for all those years and that the healthcare insurance firm he was dealing with were basically like predators that denied him the healthcare that he needed and just made it incredibly difficult for him. And that was the incident that radicalized him and caused him to go after and kill, sadly, the United Healthcare Insurance CEO. Like, he came from like an incredibly privileged background. I actually did an episode on this if you go back into my archives. He came from an incredibly privileged family where he could afford the healthcare insurance. And even in that situation, the healthcare, the insurance firm that he was dealing with made a choice on the basis of what was financially beneficial to them, even when it was at the expense of his quality of life and when it meant that the choices that they made towards him resulted in extreme like pain. Point being that insurance firms and firms in general under this capitalist system will always choose money over the well-being of people, the well-being of human beings. And that doesn't change when you introduce a commercialized avenue of dying, as is the case with assisted dying and euthanasia. And speaking of like the commercial side of things, so like the firms who make money by providing this quote unquote service, like notice as well that like the only way that these firms make money is by more people choosing to end their lives. So, and for them to make more money, they have to find a way to get more clients, more people who want to end their lives in this way. And we know how firms manufacture desire or manufacture like interest in their firms or the way in which they make us aware of the services that they provide. And that's through marketing. So in order for these like organizations or firms to make money and to make increasing levels of profits, the only way that's possible is by incentivizing increasingly more people to opt to end their lives through assisted dying or euthanasia. And for them to like find those people who might be interested in those services, guess what? Like they're going to have to prey on people in situations or in places where they might be interested in that kind of service. So you can probably expect them to find them at places like hospitals. You can probably expect them to find them in places like being advertised in places like psychologists or psychotherapists' offices, or maybe in places where people are often lost and lonely. Like imagine in like the bar in like the bathrooms or toilet stalls of like bars and like clubs and places like that. Or maybe it's like on highways, it's like on those billboards where people are doing like these long, lonely drives where they've got all this time to think and marinate on issues in their lives. And they'll see like these massive posters presenting the option of assisted dying, of this painless death that solves all issues, essentially. Like, they're going to heavily market these things, and they're going to have to necessarily prey on people who are already vulnerable, who already consider assisted dying as a legitimate and preferable, like, way out of the problems or conditions that they find themselves in. So there's no way for that not to be unethical anyway, like preying on people, advertising to people, incentivizing people who are already vulnerable, already in a position where they would even consider that a legitimate choice. Like, there's no way you can do that morally or ethically. And also, by the way, like, going back to like taking things in the context that we live in, like, one of the things that really annoys me, especially around Christmas and Valentine's Day and other sort of like big calendar events in our year, is how like adverts connect emotions that should be free and be given freely and received freely, how they connect that to like money. So for example, with Christmas, they want you to buy lots of crap for your kids and lots of crap for your partner and families. And so what they'll do is they'll have adverts that show you by going to the store, buying all these gifts and all these things, and then giving them to family members. And the family members are like, they're all smiles and happy, and they like show you lots of love, and they'll say things like, you know, show your family members that you love them, like buy them something. Or at Valentine's Day, it'll be like, show your partner you love them, buy them like roses, buy them like diamonds, buy them jewelry. So, and it's not just that they're telling you to buy it, it's that they're connecting an emotion to that. They're saying, if you do this, basically, you will get love. If you do this, you will get connection. The way to people's hearts is to buy them stuff, is to buy them this specific thing at this specific time of year. And so going back to the assisted dying, there's also going to be that level of emotional manipulation in the adverts that they use. It isn't just going to be like a black and white advert that says, if you're interested, call this number, or this is the service, this is the price. No, it's going to come with like a highly emotive scene. A scene of like an elderly person who's sick, and it's going to be, you know, we really love grandma, we really love our mom, and so the way we show mom that we love her is by helping her do what she already wants to do. Or it'll be like, because again, the nature of these companies is that for them to make money, they have to get more people. And the nature of like market acquisition is that over time, you have to increasingly like resort to creating or absorbing more and more people from the market after your initial core market. So for example, you initially, let's say you're a fashion firm, you're the fashion industry as a whole. You sell clothes to men and women, but the core chunk who buy the most clothes, as we know, is obviously women. And so you'll sell them trousers, you'll sell them dresses, you'll sell them skirts, you'll sell them scarves, you'll sell them hats. And then you'll say, you need multiple of these. You need one for every season because you want them to buy more. Then you'll say, you need them in every color because God forbid you should be caught in the same colored outfit or colored item like more than once. Then you'll tell them they need to replace it like every day because every day should be a new opportunity for you to express yourself. So the point is, they're trying to get you to buy increasingly more of this stuff, and they create all kinds of scenarios to induce you to buy that more stuff. What happens over time, though, is that they saturate the market, that the market is sapped. There are no more women for them to market to. They've already sold all the different colors, all the different items, you know, multiples of that items, even made up stuff that you don't need, but they've made you feel that you need. And so what they now do is they now start targeting men. They'll start saying to men like, you should buy a handbag because handbags are not just for women anymore. And by the way, I've got no issues with like men expressing themselves fashion-wise and choosing to wear and carry whatever accessories that they want. But the point is that the fashion industry has to now expand their market. And for them to do so, they need to manufacture desire in a group, in a new audience. So now they have to like convince men that they should wear makeup too. They have to convince men that they should carry handbags too. They have to convince men that they also can wear flowy skirts. And again, nothing wrong with any of that, but the point is that they have to continually expand their markets. And so they end up manufacturing desire in people who otherwise wouldn't have the desire for those things. And they do it as well, by the way, as I said, in very emotionally manipulative ways. Going back to the assisted dying organizations or firms that are private companies, private organizations with the incentive and the obligation to their shareholders to make money, they also need to increasingly expand their market share. And so whilst it might start off as, you know, we only offer the service to people who are terminally ill, who are facing imminent death, who suffer from chronic or debilitating illnesses or diseases or conditions, they expand that and they say, actually, we also offer it to people who aren't terminally ill. We also offer it to people who don't have chronic conditions but are in pain. We also offer it to people who don't have any physical debilitating conditions. We offer it to people who have psychological debilitating conditions. Then they say, as time goes by, actually, it's not just for like older people who are like over 60s and it's like they're at the end of their lives because of their condition anyway. Now they start saying it's actually for all adults. But what happens as the market expands is that I guarantee you they're going to start to increasingly target younger people as well. And because they've removed the requirement for like the illnesses and the terminalness, if that's a word, of their illnesses, and they removed the requirement for like it being like a chronic debilitating condition, it basically means like anybody can go for it now. And they're not even focusing on just older people, it's also younger people. I read in the Netherlands, I think it was, that you can get like euthanasia or assisted dying as young as 16 and 17. You have to have like a parent's permission if you're 16 or 17, but still it basically means there are 16 or 17 year olds that could in theory like be euthanized. Or even if they're like 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, there are young people who are like during that era of their lives, like between your teens and like the age of 25 and a little bit older, you're literally ruled by like these emotions and these hormones. And so you can have like extreme swings in how you feel about things, and you can feel incredibly bleak about life in a way that is like unique to like the era of life that you're in. Like it's a natural part of like growing up. You go through those swings and emotions. These private companies who offer assisted dying are going to increasingly have to rely on targeting younger people, not just younger people, people with like disabilities, people with mental disabilities, because again, the only way that they can continue to make money and continue to be competitive with their competitors and to beat their competition is by increasing their market share. And there's very few ways for them to do that ethically, because either they target people who are already vulnerable, or they basically expand the market to catch as many people as possible. And going back to the first thing that I talked about in terms of like my fundamental opposition to it, is that, like I said, like this conversation has to take place in the world that we live in. We don't live in like this idealized world in which like physicians aren't financially motivated or don't have to consider the costs to their firms, especially if they're like the business owners. We don't live in a world in which healthcare insurance firms act in ways that are moral and ethical and center human life and human well-being in their decision-making process. We don't live in a world in which like the governments that we live under prioritize our human lives and our human well-being over commercial or corporate interests. That's not the world that we live in, sadly. We live in like this world. And that world is a world in which even people who love us, because they face incredible levels of financial pressure, it means that when it comes to like looking after us in our most vulnerable times, in our most frail times, like that financial consideration seeps into the way that they look at us and our treatment and how they end up weighing the decisions that they face. And when you introduce the idea of assisted suicide or euthanasia to this hotbed of these different strands of issues that I've spoken about, like it's more likely than not, as I said, that in the execution of assisted dying or assisted suicide or euthanasia, it's likely that it's going to be executed in a way that is unethical or immoral or doesn't place value of human life at the center of the decision-making process. Now, I had planned on, you know, I probably have like another half an hour worth of chat that I, you know, considered putting into the episode, but I'm trying to keep the episodes like under an hour. So instead, I'm going to sign off there. I hope that you enjoyed the episode. I hope you were able to listen to the very end. If you did like the episode and enjoyed some of the content that I spoke about, I would really appreciate it if you left me a review wherever you get your podcast from. I'll be back next Monday as usual. Until then, my email is available if you have any comments or questions or thoughts that you wanted to share. As always, I also have some, you know, articles you might be interested in the show notes that I'll probably add those notes tomorrow. But enjoy the rest of your week, and I'll catch you next Monday.